From the age of Constantine to the Plantagenets, this rapacious spirit continued to instigate the poor and hardy Caledonians. But the same people, whose generous humanity seems to inspire the songs of Ossian, was disgraced by savage ignorance of the virtues of peace and of the laws of war. Their southern neighbors have felt, and perhaps exaggerated, the cruel depredations of the Scots and Picts, and a valiant tribe of Caledonia, the Atacotti, the enemies, and afterwards the soldiers of Valentinian, are accused by an eyewitness of delighting in the taste of human flesh. When they hunted the woods for prey, it is said that they attacked the shepherd rather than his flock, and that they curiously selected the most delicate and brawny parts, both of males and females, which they prepared for their horrid repasts. If, in the neighborhood of the commercial and literary town of Glasgow, a race of cannibals has really existed, we may contemplate in the period of the Scottish history the opposite extremes of savage and civilized life. Such reflections tend to enlarge the circle of our ideas, and to encourage the pleasing hope that New Zealand may produce in some future age the Hume of the Southern Hemisphere. Every messenger who escaped across the British Channel conveyed the most melancholy and alarming tidings to the ears of Valentinian, and the Emperor was soon informed that the two military commanders of the province had been surprised and cut off by the barbarians. Severus, Count of the Domestics, was hastily dispatched, and as suddenly recalled by the court of Trier. The representations of Jovinus served only to indicate the greatness of the evil, and after a long and serious consultation, the defense, or rather the recovery, of Britain was entrusted to the abilities of the brave Theodosius. The exploits of that general, the father of a line of emperors, have been celebrated with peculiar complacency by the writers of the age. But his real merit deserved their applause, and his nomination was received by the army and province as a sure presage of approaching victory. He seized the favorable moment of navigation and securely landed the numerous and veteran bands of the Heruli and Batavians, the Jovians and the Victors. In his march from Sandwich to London, Theodosius defeated several parties of the barbarians, released a multitude of captives, and after distributing to his soldiers a small portion of the spoil, established the fame of disinterested justice by the restitution of the remainder to the rightful proprietors. The citizens of London, who had almost despaired of their safety, threw open their gates, and as soon as Theodosius had obtained from the court of Trier the important aid of a military lieutenant and a civil governor, he executed with wisdom and vigor the laborious task of the deliverance of Britain. The vagrant soldiers were recalled to their standard, an edict of amnesty dispelled the public apprehensions, and his cheerful example alleviated the rigor of martial discipline. The scattered and desultory warfare of the barbarians who infested the land and sea deprived him of the glory of a signal victory. But the prudent spirit and consummate art of the Roman general were displayed in the operations of two campaigns which successively rescued every part of the province from the hands of a cruel and rapacious enemy. The splendor of the cities and the security of the fortifications were diligently restored by the paternal care of Theodosius, who with a strong hand confined the trembling Caledonians to the northern angle of the island, and perpetuated by the name and settlement of the new province of Valentia, the glories of the reign of Valentinian. The voice of poetry and panegyric may add, perhaps with some degree of truth, that the unknown regions of Thule were stained with the blood of the Picts, that the oars of Theodosius dashed the waves of the Hyperborean Ocean, and that the distant Orkneys were the scene of his naval victory over the Saxon pirates. He left the province with a fair as well as splendid reputation, and was immediately promoted to the rank of Master General of the Cavalry by a prince who could applaud, without envy, the merit of his servants. In the important station of the Upper Danube, the conqueror of Britain checked and defeated the armies of the Alemanni, before he was chosen to suppress the revolt of Africa. The prince who refuses to be the judge instructs the people to consider him as the accomplice of his ministers. The military command of Africa had been long exercised by Count Romanus, and his abilities were not inadequate to his station. But as sordid interest was the sole motive of his conduct, he acted on most occasions as if he had been the enemy of the province and the friend of the barbarians of the desert. The three flourishing cities of Oea, Leptis, and Sobrata, which under the name of Tripoli had long constituted a federal union, were obliged for the first time to shut their gates against a hostile invasion. Several of their most honorable citizens were surprised and massacred. The villages and even the suburbs were pillaged, and the vines and fruit trees of that rich territory were extirpated by the malicious savages of Getulia. The unhappy provincials implored the protection of Romanus, but they soon found that their military governor was not less cruel and rapacious than the barbarians. As they were incapable of furnishing the 4,000 camels and the exorbitant present which he required before he would march to the assistance of Tripoli, his demand was equivalent to a refusal, and he might justly be accused as the author of the public calamity. In the annual assembly of the three cities, they nominated two deputies to lay at the feet of Valentinian the customary offering of a gold victory, and to accompany this tribute of duty, rather than of gratitude, with their humble complaint that they were ruined by the enemy and betrayed by their governor. If the severity of Valentinian had been rightly directed, it would have fallen on the guilty head of Romanus. But the count, long exercised in the arts of corruption, had dispatched a swift and trusty messenger to secure the venal friendship of Remigius, master of the offices. The wisdom of the imperial council was deceived by artifice, and their honest indignation was cooled by delay. At length, when the repetition of complaint had been justified by the repetition of public misfortunes, the notary Palladius was sent from the court of Trier to examine the state of Africa and the conduct of Romanus. The rigid impartiality of Palladius was easily disarmed. He was tempted to reserve for himself a part of the public treasure which he brought with him for the payment of the troops. And from the moment that he was conscious of his own guilt, he could no longer refuse to attest the innocence and merit of the count. The charge of the Tripolitans was declared to be false and frivolous, and Palladius himself was sent back from Trier to Africa with a special commission to discover and prosecute the authors of this impious conspiracy against the representatives of the sovereign. His inquiries were managed with so much dexterity and success that he compelled the citizens of Leptis, who had sustained a recent siege of 8 days, to contradict the truth of their own decrees, and to censure the behavior of their own deputies. A bloody sentence was pronounced without hesitation by the rash and headstrong cruelty of Valentinian. The president of Tripoli, who had presumed to pity the distress of the province, was publicly executed at Utica. 4 distinguished citizens were put to death as the accomplices of the imaginary fraud, and the tongues of 2 others were cut out by the express order of the emperor. Romanus, elated by impunity and irritated by resistance, was still continued in the military command, till the Africans were provoked by his avarice to join the rebellious standard of Firmus the Moor. His father, Nabal, was one of the richest and most powerful of the Moorish princes who acknowledged the supremacy of Rome. But as he left, either by his wives or concubines, a very numerous posterity, the wealthy inheritance was eagerly disputed, and Zama, one of his sons, was slain in a domestic quarrel by his brother Firmus. the implacable zeal with which Romanus prosecuted the legal revenge of this murder could be ascribed only to a motive of avarice or personal hatred. But on this occasion his claims were just. His influence was weighty, and Firmus clearly understood that he must either present his neck to the executioner or appeal from the sentence of the imperial consistory to his sword and to the people. He was received as the deliverer of his country, and as soon as it appeared that Romanus was formidable only to a submissive province, the tyrant of Africa became the object of universal contempt. The ruin of Caesarea, which was plundered and burnt by the licentious barbarians, convinced the refractory cities of the danger of resistance. The power of Firmus was established, at least in the provinces of Mauritania and Numidia, and it seemed to be his only doubt whether he should assume the diadem of a Moorish king or the purple of a Roman emperor. But the imprudent and unhappy Africans soon discovered that in this rash insurrection they had not sufficiently consulted their own strength or the abilities of their leader. Before he could procure any certain intelligence that the Emperor of the West had fixed the choice of a general or that a fleet of transports was collected at the mouth of the Rhone, he was suddenly informed that the great Theodosius, with a small band of veterans, had landed near Igilgilis, or Gigeri, on the African coast, and the timid usurper sunk under the ascendant of virtue and military genius. Though Firmus possessed arms and treasures, his despair of victory immediately reduced him to the use of those arts which, in the same country and in a similar situation, had formerly been practiced by the crafty Jugurtha. He attempted to deceive, by an apparent submission, the vigilance of the Roman general, to seduce the fidelity of his troops, and to protract the duration of the war by successively engaging the independent tribes of Africa to espouse his quarrel or to protect his flight. Theodosius imitated the example and obtained the success of his predecessor, Metellus. When Firmus, in the character of a suppliant, accused his own rashness and humbly solicited the clemency of the emperor, the lieutenant of Valentinian received and dismissed him with a friendly embrace. But he diligently required the useful and substantial pledges of a sincere repentance. Nor could he be persuaded by the assurances of peace to suspend for an instant the operations of an active war. A dark conspiracy was detected by the penetration of Theodosius, and he satisfied, without much reluctance, the public indignation which he had secretly excited. Several of the guilty accomplices of Firmus were abandoned, according to ancient custom, to the tumult of a military execution. Many more, by the amputation of both their hands, continued to exhibit an instructive spectacle of horror. The hatred of the rebels was accompanied with fear, and the fear of the Roman soldiers was mingled with respectful admiration. Amid the boundless plains of Getulia and the innumerable valleys of Mount Atlas, it was impossible to prevent the escape of Firmus, and if the usurper could have tired the patience of his antagonist, he would have secured his person in the depth of some remote solitude and expected the hopes of a future revolution. He was subdued by the perseverance of Theodosius, who had formed an inflexible determination that the war should end only by the death of the tyrant, and that every nation of Africa which presumed to support his cause should be involved in his ruin. At the head of a small body of troops, which seldom exceeded 3,500 men, the Roman general advanced with a steady prudence, devoid of rashness or of fear, into the heart of a country where he was sometimes attacked by armies of 20,000 Moors. The boldness of his charge dismayed the irregular barbarians. They were disconcerted by his seasonable and orderly retreats. They were continually baffled by the unknown resources of the military art, and they felt and confessed the just superiority which was assumed by the leader of a civilized nation. When Theodosius entered the extensive dominions of Igmazin, king of the Isaflenses, The haughty savage required, in words of defiance, his name and the object of his expedition. "I am," replied the stern and disdainful count, "I am the general of Valentinian, the lord of the world, who has sent me hither to pursue and punish a desperate robber. Deliver him instantly into my hands, and be assured that if thou dost not obey the commands of my invincible sovereign, thou, and the people over whom thou reignest, shall be utterly extirpated." As soon as Igmazen was satisfied that his enemy had strength and resolution to execute the fatal menace, he consented to purchase a necessary peace by the sacrifice of a guilty fugitive. The guards that were placed to secure the person of Firmus deprived him of the hopes of escape, and the Moorish tyrant, after wine had extinguished the sense of danger, disappointed the insulting triumph of the Romans by strangling himself in the night. His dead body, the only present which Igmazin could offer to the conqueror, was carelessly thrown upon a camel, and Theodosius, leading back his victorious troops to Sitifi, was saluted by the warmest acclamations of joy and loyalty. Africa had been lost by the vices of Romanus. It was restored by the virtues of Theodosius, and our curiosity may be usefully directed to the inquiry of the respective treatment which the two generals received from the imperial court. The authority of Count Romanus had been suspended by the Master General of the Cavalry, and he was committed to safe and honorable custody till the end of the war. His crimes were proved by the most authentic evidence, and the public expected with some impatience the decree of severe justice. But the partial and powerful favor of Meliboeus encouraged him to challenge his legal judges, to obtain repeated delays for the purpose of procuring a crowd of friendly witnesses, and finally to cover his guilty conduct by the additional guilt of fraud and forgery. About the same time, the restorer of Britain and Africa, on a vague suspicion that his name and services were superior to the rank of a subject, was ignominiously beheaded at Carthage. Valentinian no longer reigned, and the death of Theodosius, as well as the impunity of Romanus, may justly be imputed to the arts of the ministers who abused the confidence and deceived the inexperienced youth of his sons. If the geographical accuracy of Ammianus had been fortunately bestowed on the British exploits of Theodosius, we should have traced with eager curiosity the distinct and domestic footsteps of his march. But the tedious enumeration of the unknown and uninteresting tribes of Africa may be reduced to the general remark that they were all of the swarthy race of the Moors, that they inhabited the back settlements of the Mauritanian and Numidian province, the country, as they have since been termed by the Arabs, of dates and of locusts, and that as the Roman power declined in Africa, the boundary of civilized manners and cultivated land was insensibly contracted. Beyond the utmost limits of the Moors, the vast and inhospitable desert of the south extends above 1,000 miles to the banks of the Niger. The ancients, who had a very faint and imperfect knowledge of the great peninsula of Africa, were sometimes tempted to believe that the torrid zone must ever remain destitute of inhabitants, and they sometimes amused their fancy by filling the vacant space with headless men, or rather monsters, with horned and cloven-footed satyrs, with fabulous centaurs, and with human pygmies who waged a bold and doubtful warfare against the cranes. Carthage would have trembled at the strange intelligence that the countries on either side of the equator were filled with innumerable nations who differed only in their color from the ordinary appearance of the human species, and the subjects of the Roman Empire might have anxiously expected that the swarms of barbarians which issued from the north would soon be encountered from the south by new swarms of barbarians, equally fierce and equally formidable. These gloomy terrors would indeed have been dispelled by a more intimate acquaintance with the character of their African enemies. The inaction of the Negroes does not seem to be the effect either of their virtue or of their pusillanimity. They indulge, like the rest of mankind, their passions and appetites, and the adjacent tribes are engaged in frequent acts of hostility. But their rude ignorance has never invented any effectual weapons of defense or of destruction. They appear incapable of forming any extensive plans of government or conquest, and the obvious inferiority of their mental faculties has been discovered and abused by the nations of the temperate zone. 60,000 blacks are annually embarked from the coast of Guinea, never to return to their native country. But they are embarked in chains. And this constant emigration, which in the space of 2 centuries might have furnished armies to overrun the globe, accuses the guilt of Europe and the weakness of Africa. The ignominious treaty which saved the army of Jovian had been faithfully executed on the side of the Romans, and as they had solemnly renounced the sovereignty and alliance of Armenia and Iberia, those tributary kingdoms were exposed without protection to the arms of the Persian monarch. Sapor entered the Armenian territories at the head of a formidable host of cuirassiers, of archers, and of mercenary foot. But it was the invariable practice of Sapor to mix war and negotiation, and to consider falsehood and perjury as the most powerful instruments of regal policy. He affected to praise the prudent and moderate conduct of the king of Armenia, and the unsuspicious Tyrannus was persuaded by the repeated assurances of insidious friendship to deliver his person into the hands of a faithless and cruel enemy. In the midst of a splendid entertainment, he was bound in chains of silver, as an honor due to the blood of the Arsacides. And after a short confinement in the Tower of Oblivion at Ecbatana, he was released from the miseries of life, either by his own dagger or by that of an assassin. The kingdom of Armenia was reduced to the state of a Persian province. The administration was shared between a distinguished satrap and a favorite eunuch, and Sapor marched without delay to subdue the martial spirit of the Iberians. Saramekis, who reigned in that country by the permission of the emperors, was expelled by a superior force, and as an insult on the majesty of Rome, the King of Kings placed a diadem on the head of his abject vassal, Aspacuras. The city of Artogerassa was the only place of Armenia which presumed to resist the efforts of his arms. The treasure deposited in that strong fortress tempted the avarice of Sapor, but the danger of Olympias, the wife or widow of the Armenian king, excited the public compassion and animated the desperate valor of her subjects and soldiers. The Persians were surprised and repulsed under the walls of Artagarasa by a bold and well-concerted sally of the besieged. But the forces of Sapor were continually renewed and increased. The hopeless courage of the garrison was exhausted. The strength of the walls yielded to the assault, and the proud conqueror, after wasting the rebellious city with fire and sword, led away captive an unfortunate queen, who in a more auspicious hour had been the destined bride of the son of Constantine. Yet if Sapor already triumphed in the easy conquest of 2 dependent kingdoms, he soon felt that a country is unsubdued as long as the minds of the people are actuated by a hostile and contumacious spirit. The satraps whom he was obliged to trust embraced the first opportunity of regaining the affection of their countrymen, and of signalizing their immortal hatred to the Persian name. Since the conversion of the Armenians and Iberians, these nations considered the Christians as the favorites and the Magians as the adversaries of the Supreme Being. The influence of the clergy over a superstitious people was uniformly exerted in the cause of Rome, and as long as the successors of Constantine disputed with those of Artaxerxes the sovereignty of the intermediate provinces, the religious connection always threw a decisive advantage into the scale of the empire. a numerous and active party, acknowledged Para, the son of Tyrannus, as the lawful sovereign of Armenia, and his title to the throne was deeply rooted in the hereditary succession of 500 years. By the unanimous consent of the Iberians, the country was equally divided between the rival princes, and Aspacuras, who owed his diadem to the choice of Sapor, was obliged to declare that his regard for his children, who were detained as hostages by the tyrant, was the only consideration which prevented him from openly renouncing the alliance of Persia. The Emperor Valens, who respected the obligations of the treaty, and who was apprehensive of involving the East in a dangerous war, ventured with slow and cautious measures to support the Roman party in the kingdoms of Iberia and Armenia. 12 legions established the authority of Sarameces on the banks of the Cyrus. The Euphrates was protected by the valor of Arinthius. A powerful army under the command of Count Trajan and of Vedomir, king of the Alemanni, fixed their camp on the confines of Armenia. But they were strictly enjoined not to commit the first hostilities, which might be understood as a breach of the treaty. And such was the implicit obedience of the Roman general that they retreated with exemplary patience under a shower of Persian arrows, till they had clearly acquired a just title to an honorable and legitimate victory. Yet these appearances of war insensibly subsided in a vain and tedious negotiation. The contending parties supported their claims by mutual reproaches of perfidy and ambition, and it should seem that the original treaty was expressed in very obscure terms, since they were reduced to the necessity of making their inconclusive appeal to the partial testimony of the generals of the two nations, who had assisted at the negotiations. The invasion of the Goths and Huns, which soon afterwards shook the foundations of the Roman Empire, exposed the provinces of Asia to the arms of Sapor. But the declining age, and perhaps the infirmities of the monarch, suggested new maxims of tranquillity and moderation. His death, which happened in the full maturity of a reign of 70 years, changed in a moment the court and councils of Persia, and their attention was most probably engaged by domestic troubles and the distant efforts of a Carmanian war. The remembrance of ancient injuries was lost in the enjoyment of peace. The kingdoms of Armenia and Iberia were permitted by the mutual, though tacit, consent of both empires to resume their doubtful neutrality. In the first years of the reign of Theodosius, a Persian embassy arrived at Constantinople to excuse the unjustifiable measures of the former reign, and to offer as the tribute of friendship, or even of respect, a splendid present of gems, of silk, and of Indian elephants. In the general picture of the affairs of the East under the reign of Valens, the adventures of Para form one of the most striking and singular objects. The noble youth, by the persuasion of his mother, Olympias, had escaped through the Persian host that besieged Artagerassa, and implored the protection of the Emperor of the East. By his timid counsels, Para was alternately supported and recalled and restored and betrayed. The hopes of the Armenians were sometimes raised by the presence of their natural sovereign, and the ministers of Valens were satisfied that they preserved the integrity of the public faith if their vassal was not suffered to assume the diadem and title of king. But they soon repented of their own rashness. They were confounded by the reproaches and threats of the Persian monarch. They found reason to distrust the cruel and inconstant temper of Para himself, who sacrificed to the slightest suspicions the lives of his most faithful servants, and held a secret and disgraceful correspondence with the assassin of his father and the enemy of his country. Under the specious pretense of consulting with the emperor on the subject of their common interest, Para was persuaded to descend from the mountains of Armenia, where his party was in arms, and to trust his independence and safety to the discretion of a perfidious court. The king of Armenia, for such he appeared in his own eyes and in those of his nation, was received with due honors by the governors of the provinces through which he passed. But when he arrived at Tarsus in Cilicia, his progress was stopped under various pretenses. His motions were watched with respectful vigilance, and he gradually discovered that he was a prisoner in the hands of the Romans. Para suppressed his indignation, dissembled his fears, and after secretly preparing his escape, mounted on horseback with 300 of his faithful followers. The officer stationed at the door of his apartment immediately communicated his flight to the consular of Cilicia, who overtook him in the suburbs and endeavored without success to dissuade him from prosecuting his rash and dangerous design. A legion was ordered to pursue the royal fugitive, but the pursuit of infantry could not be very alarming to a body of light cavalry, and upon the first cloud of arrows that was discharged into the air, they retreated with precipitation to the gates of Tarsus. After an incessant march of 2 days and 2 nights, Para and his Armenians reached the banks of the Euphrates. But the passage of the river, which they were obliged to swim, was attended with some delay and some loss. The country was alarmed, and the two roads, which were only separated by an interval of 3 miles, had been occupied by 1,000 archers on horseback under the command of a count and a tribune. Para must have yielded to superior force if the accidental arrival of a friendly traveler had not revealed the danger and the means of escape. A dark and almost impervious path securely conveyed the Armenian troop through the thicket, and Para had left behind him the count and the tribune, while they patiently expected his approach along the public highways. They returned to the imperial court to excuse their want of diligence or success, and seriously alleged that the king of Armenia, who was a skillful magician, had transformed himself and his followers and passed before their eyes under a borrowed shape. After his return to his native kingdom, Para still continued to profess himself the friend and ally of the Romans. But the Romans had injured him too deeply ever to forgive, and the secret sentence of his death was signed in the Council of Valens. The execution of the bloody deed was committed to the subtle prudence of Count Trajan, and he had the merit of insinuating himself into the confidence of the credulous prince that he might find an opportunity of stabbing him to the heart. Para was invited to a Roman banquet, which had been prepared with all the pomp and sensuality of the East. The hall resounded with cheerful music, and the company was already heated with wine, when the count retired for an instant, drew his sword, and gave the signal of the murder. A robust and desperate barbarian instantly rushed on the king of Armenia, and though he bravely defended his life with the first weapon that chance offered to his hand, the table of the imperial general was stained with the royal blood of a guest and an ally. Such were the weak and wicked maxims of the Roman administration that, to attain a doubtful object of political interest, the laws of nations and the sacred rites of hospitality were inhumanly violated in the face of the world. During a peaceful interval of 30 years, the Romans secured their frontiers, and the Goths extended their dominions. The victories of the great Hermanric, king of the Ostrogoths, and the most noble of the race of the Amali, have been compared by the enthusiasm of his countrymen to the exploits of Alexander, with this singular and almost incredible difference, that the martial spirit of the Gothic hero, instead of being supported by the vigor of youth, was displayed with glory and success in the extreme period of human life, between the age of 80 and 110 years. The independent tribes were persuaded or compelled to acknowledge the king of the Ostrogoths as the sovereign of the Gothic nation. The chiefs of the Visigoths, or Thervingi, renounced the royal title and assumed the more humble appellation of judges. And among those judges, Athanaric, Fritigern, and Alvivus were the most illustrious by their personal merit, as well as by their vicinity to the Roman provinces. These domestic conquests, which increased the military power of Hermanric, enlarged his ambitious designs. He invaded the adjacent countries of the north, and 12 considerable nations, whose names and limits cannot be accurately defined, successively yielded to the superiority of the Gothic arms. The Heruli, who inhabited the marshy lands near the lake Meotis, were renowned for their strength and agility, and the assistance of their light infantry was eagerly solicited and highly esteemed in all the wars of the barbarians. But the active spirit of the Heruli was subdued by the slow and steady perseverance of the Goths. And after a bloody action in which the king was slain, the remains of that warlike tribe became a useful accession to the camp of Hermanric. He then marched against the Venedi, unskilled in the use of arms and formidable only by their numbers, which filled the wide extent of the plains of modern Poland. The victorious Goths, who were not inferior in numbers, prevailed in the contest by the decisive advantages of exercise and discipline. After the submission of the Venedi, the conqueror advanced without resistance as far as the confines of the Isti, an ancient people whose name is still preserved in the province of Estonia. Those distant inhabitants of the Baltic coast were supported by the labors of agriculture, enriched by the trade of amber, and consecrated by the peculiar worship of the Mother of the Gods. But the scarcity of iron obliged the Estian warriors to content themselves with wooden clubs, and the reduction of that wealthy country is ascribed to the prudence rather than to the arms of Hermanric. His dominions, which extended from the Danube to the Baltic, included the native seats and the recent acquisitions of the Goths, and he reigned over the greatest part of Germany and Scythia with the authority of a conqueror, and sometimes with the cruelty of a tyrant. But he reigned over a part of the globe incapable of perpetuating and adorning the glory of its heroes. The name of Hermanric is almost buried in oblivion. His exploits are imperfectly known, and the Romans themselves appeared unconscious of the progress of an aspiring power which threatened the liberty of the north and the peace of the empire. The Goths had contracted an hereditary attachment for the imperial house of Constantine, of whose power and liberality they had received so many signal proofs. They respected the public peace, and if a hostile band sometimes presumed to pass the Roman limit, their irregular conduct was candidly ascribed to the ungovernable spirit of the barbarian youth. Their contempt for two new and obscure princes who had been raised to the throne by popular election inspired the Goths with bolder hopes, and while they agitated some design of marching their confederate force under the national standard, they were easily tempted to embrace the party of Procopius, and to foment by their dangerous aid the civil discord of the Romans. The public treaty might stipulate no more than 10,000 auxiliaries, but the design was so zealously adopted by the chiefs of the Visigoths that the army which passed the Danube amounted to the number of 30,000 men. They marched with the proud confidence that their invincible valor would decide the fate of the Roman Empire, and the provinces of Thrace groaned under the weight of the barbarians, who displayed the insolence of masters and the licentiousness of enemies. But the intemperance which gratified their appetites retarded their progress, and before the Goths could receive any certain intelligence of the defeat and death of Procopius, they perceived, by the hostile state of the country, that the civil and military powers were resumed by his successful rival. A chain of posts and fortifications, skillfully disposed by Valens, or the generals of Valens, resisted their march, prevented their retreat, and intercepted their subsistence. The fierceness of the barbarians was tamed and suspended by hunger. They indignantly threw down their arms at the feet of the conqueror, who offered them food and chains. The numerous captives were distributed in all the cities of the east, and the provincials, who were soon familiarized with their savage appearance, ventured, by degrees, to measure their own strength with these formidable adversaries, whose name had so long been the object of their terror. The king of Scythia, and Hermanric alone could deserve so lofty a title, was grieved and exasperated by this national calamity. His ambassadors loudly complained at the court of Valence of the infraction of the ancient and solemn alliance which had so long subsisted between the Romans and the Goths. They alleged that they had fulfilled the duty of allies by assisting the kinsman and successor of the Emperor Julian. They required the immediate restitution of the noble captives, and they urged a very singular claim that the Gothic generals marching in arms and in hostile array were entitled to the sacred character and privileges of ambassadors. The decent but peremptory refusal of these extravagant demands was signified to the barbarians by Victor, Master General of the Cavalry, who expressed with force and dignity the just complaints of the Emperor of the East. The negotiation was interrupted, and the manly exhortations of Valentinian encouraged his timid brother to vindicate the insulted majesty of the empire. The splendor and magnitude of this Gothic war are celebrated by a contemporary historian, but the events scarcely deserve the attention of posterity, except as the preliminary steps of the approaching decline and fall of the empire. Instead of leading the nations of Germany and Scythia to the banks of the Danube, or even to the gates of Constantinople, the aged monarch of the Goths resigned to the brave Athanaric the danger and glory of a defensive war against an enemy who wielded with a feeble hand the powers of a mighty state. A bridge of boats was established upon the Danube. The presence of Valens animated his troops, and his ignorance of the art of war was compensated by personal bravery and a wise deference to the advice of Victor and Arinthius, his masters general of the cavalry and infantry. The operations of the campaign were conducted by their skill and experience, but they found it impossible to drive the Visigoths from their strong posts in the mountains, and the devastation of the plains obliged the Romans themselves to repass the Danube in the approach of winter. The incessant rains, which swelled the waters of the river, produced a tacit suspension of arms and confined the Emperor Valens, during the whole course of the ensuing summer, to his camp of Marcianopolis. The third year of the war was more favorable to the Romans and more pernicious to the Goths. The interruption of trade deprived the barbarians of the objects of luxury, which they already confounded with the necessaries of life, and the desolation of a very extensive tract of country threatened them with the horrors of famine. Athanaric was provoked or compelled to risk a battle which he lost in the plains, and the pursuit was rendered more bloody by the cruel precaution of the victorious generals, who had promised a large reward for the head of every Goth that was brought into the imperial camp. The submission of the barbarians appeased the resentment of Valens and his council. The emperor listened with satisfaction to the flattering and eloquent remonstrance of the Senate of Constantinople, which assumed for the first time a share in the public deliberations, and the same generals, Victor and Arinthius, who had successfully directed the conduct of the war, were empowered to regulate the conditions of peace. The freedom of trade which the Goths had hitherto enjoyed was restricted to two cities on the Danube. The rashness of their leaders was severely punished by the suppression of their pensions and subsidies, and the exception, which was stipulated in favor of Athanaric alone, was more advantageous than honorable to the judge of the Visigoths. Athanaric, who on this occasion appears to have consulted his private interest without expecting the orders of his sovereign, supported his own dignity and that of his tribe in the personal interview which was proposed by the ministers of Valens. He persisted in his declaration that it was impossible for him, without incurring the guilt of perjury, ever to set his foot on the territory of the empire, and it is more than probable that his regard for the sanctity of an oath was confirmed by the recent and fatal examples of Roman treachery. The Danube, which separated the dominions of the two independent nations, was chosen for the scene of the conference. The Emperor of the East and the Judge of the Visigoths, accompanied by an equal number of armed followers, advanced in their respective barges to the middle of the stream. After the ratification of the treaty and the delivery of hostages, Valens returned in triumph to Constantinople, and the Goths remained in a state of tranquility about 6 years, till they were violently impelled against the Roman Empire by an innumerable host of Scythians, who appeared to issue from the frozen regions of the north. The Emperor of the West, who had resigned to his brother the command of the Lower Danube, reserved for his immediate care the defense of the Rhaetian and Illyrian provinces, which spread so many hundred miles along the greatest of the European rivers. The active policy of Valentinian was continually employed in adding new fortifications to the security of the frontier. But the abuse of this policy provoked the just resentment of the barbarians. The Quadi complained that the ground for an intended fortress had been marked out on their territories, and their complaints were urged with so much reason and moderation that Equitius, master general of Illyricum, consented to suspend the prosecution of the work till he should be more clearly informed of the will of his sovereign. This fair occasion of injuring a rival and of advancing the fortune of his son was eagerly embraced by the inhuman Maximin, the prefect, or rather tyrant, of Gaul. The passions of Valentinian were impatient of control, and he credulously listened to the assurances of his favorite that if the government of Valeria and the direction of the work were entrusted to the zeal of his son Marcellinus, the emperor should no longer be importuned with the audacious remonstrances of the barbarians. The subjects of Rome and the natives of Germany were insulted by the arrogance of a young and worthless minister who considered his rapid elevation as the proof and reward of his superior merit. He affected, however, to receive the modest application of Gabinius, king of the Quadi, with some attention and regard. But this artful civility concealed a dark and bloody design, and the credulous prince was persuaded to accept the pressing invitation of Marcellinus. I am at a loss how to vary the narrative of similar crimes, or how to relate that in the course of the same year, but in remote parts of the empire, the inhospitable table of two imperial generals was stained with the royal blood of two guests and allies, inhumanly murdered by their order, and in their presence. The fate of Gabinius and of Parra was the same, but the cruel death of their sovereign was resented in a very different manner by the servile temper of the Armenians and the free and daring spirit of the Germans. The Quadi were much declined from that formidable power which in the time of Marcus Antoninus had spread terror to the gates of Rome. But they still possessed arms and courage. Their courage was animated by despair, and they obtained the usual reinforcement of the cavalry of their Sarmatian allies. So improvident was the assassin Marcellinus that he chose the moment when the bravest veterans had been drawn away to suppress the revolt of Firmus, and the whole province was exposed with a very feeble defense to the rage of the exasperated barbarians. They invaded Pannonia in the season of harvest, unmercifully destroyed every object of plunder which they could not easily transport, and either disregarded or demolished the empty fortifications. The princess Constantia, the daughter of the Emperor Constantius, and the granddaughter of the great Constantine, very narrowly escaped. That royal maid who had innocently supported the revolt of Procopius was now the destined wife of the heir of the Western Empire. She traversed the peaceful province with a splendid and unarmed train. Her person was saved from danger and the Republic from disgrace by the active zeal of Messala, governor of the provinces. As soon as he was informed that the village where she stopped only to dine was almost encompassed by the barbarians, he hastily placed her in his own chariot and drove full speed till he reached the gates of Sirmium, which were at the distance of 26 miles. Even Sirmium might not have been secure if the Quadi and Sarmatians had diligently advanced during the general consternation of the magistrates and people. Their delay allowed Probus, the Praetorian prefect, sufficient time to recover his own spirits and to revive the courage of the citizens. He skillfully directed their strenuous efforts to repair and strengthen the decayed fortifications, and procured the seasonable and effectual assistance of a company of archers to protect the capital of the Illyrian provinces. Disappointed in their attempts against the walls of Sirmium, the indignant barbarians turned their arms against the master general of the frontier, to whom they unjustly attributed the murder of their king. Aquitius could bring into the field no more than 2 legions, but they contained the veteran strength of the Mycian and Pannonian bands. The obstinacy with which they disputed the vain honors of rank and precedency was the cause of their destruction, and while they acted with separate forces and divided councils, they were surprised and slaughtered by the active vigor of the Sarmatian horse. The success of this invasion provoked the emulation of the bordering tribes, and the province of Mysia would infallibly have been lost if young Theodosius, the duke or military commander of the frontier, had not signalized in the defeat of the public enemy an intrepid genius worthy of his illustrious father and of his future greatness. The mind of Valentinian, who then resided at Trier, was deeply affected by the calamities of Illyricum. But the lateness of the season suspended the execution of his designs till the ensuing spring. He marched in person with a considerable part of the forces of Gaul from the banks of the Moselle, and to the suppliant ambassadors of the Sarmatians who met him on the way, he returned a doubtful answer that as soon as he reached the scene of action, he should examine and pronounce. When he arrived at Sirmium, he gave audience to the deputies of the Illyrian provinces, who loudly congratulated their own felicity under the auspicious government of Probus, his praetorian prefect. Valentinian, who was flattered by these demonstrations of their loyalty and gratitude, imprudently asked the deputy of Epirus, a cynic philosopher of intrepid sincerity, whether he was freely sent by the wishes of the province. "With tears and groans am I sent," replied Iphicles, "by a reluctant people." The emperor paused, but the impunity of his ministers established the pernicious maxim that they might oppress his subjects without injuring his service. A strict inquiry into their conduct would have relieved the public discontent. The severe condemnation of the murder of Gabinius was the only measure which could restore the confidence of the Germans and vindicate the honor of the Roman name. But the haughty monarch was incapable of the magnanimity which dares to acknowledge a fault. He forgot the provocation, remembered only the injury, and advanced into the country of the Quadi with an insatiate thirst of blood and revenge. The extreme devastation and promiscuous massacre of a savage war were justified in the eyes of the emperor, and perhaps in those of the world, by the cruel equity of retaliation. And such was the discipline of the Romans and the consternation of the enemy that Valentinian repassed the Danube without the loss of a single man. As he had resolved to complete the destruction of the Quadi by a second campaign, he fixed his winter quarters at Brigetio on the Danube, near the Hungarian city of Pressburg. While the operations of war were suspended by the severity of the weather, the Quadi made an humble attempt to deprecate the wrath of their conqueror, and at the earnest persuasion of Aquitius, their ambassadors were introduced into the imperial council. They approached the throne with bended bodies and dejected countenances, and without daring to complain of the murder of their king, They affirmed with solemn oaths that the late invasion was the crime of some irregular robbers, which the public council of the nation condemned and abhorred. The answer of the emperor left them but little to hope from his clemency or compassion. He reviled in the most intemperate language their baseness, their ingratitude, their insolence. His eyes, his voice, his color, his gestures expressed the violence of his ungoverned fury, and while his whole frame was agitated with convulsive passion, a large blood vessel suddenly burst in his body, and Valentinian fell speechless into the arms of his attendants. Their pious care immediately concealed his situation from the crowd, but in a few minutes the Emperor of the West expired in an agony of pain, retaining his senses till the last, and struggling, without success, to declare his intentions to the generals and ministers who surrounded the royal couch. Valentinian was about 54 years of age, and he wanted only 100 days to accomplish the 12 years of his reign. The polygamy of Valentinian is seriously attested by an ecclesiastical historian. The Empress of Severa, I relate the fable, admitted into her familiar society the lovely Justina, the daughter of an Italian governor. Her admiration of those naked charms which she had often seen in the bath was expressed with such lavish and imprudent praise that the emperor was tempted to introduce a second wife into his bed, and his public edict extended to all the subjects of the empire the same domestic privilege which he had assumed for himself. But we may be assured, from the evidence of reason as well as history, that the two marriages of Valentinian with Severa and with Justina were successively contracted, and that he used the ancient permission of divorce, which was still allowed by the laws, though it was condemned by the Church. Severa was the mother of Gratian, who seemed to unite every claim which could entitle him to the undoubted succession of the Western Empire. He was the eldest son of a monarch whose glorious reign had confirmed the free and honorable choice of his fellow soldiers. Before he had attained the 9th year of his age, the royal youth received from the hands of his indulgent father the purple robe and diadem with the title of Augustus. The election was solemnly ratified by the consent and applause of the armies of Gaul, and the name of Gratian was added to the names of Valentinian and Valens in all the legal transactions of the Roman government. By his marriage with the granddaughter of Constantine, the son of Valentinian acquired all the hereditary rights of the Flavian family, which in a series of 3 imperial generations were sanctified by time, religion, and the reverence of the people. At the death of his father, the royal youth was in the 17th year of his age, and his virtues already justified the favorable opinion of the army and the people. But Gratian resided without apprehension in the palace of Trier, while at the distance of many 100 miles, Valentinian suddenly expired in the camp of Burgetio. The passions which had been so long suppressed by the presence of a master immediately revived in the imperial council, and the ambitious design of reigning in the name of an infant was artfully executed by Melobaudes and Equitius, who commanded the attachment of the Illyrian and Italian bands. They contrived the most honorable pretenses to remove the popular leaders and the troops of Gaul who might have asserted the claims of the lawful successor. They suggested the necessity of extinguishing the hopes of foreign and domestic enemies by a bold and decisive measure. The Empress Justina, who had been left in a palace about 100 miles from Brigetio, was respectively invited to appear in the camp with the son of the deceased emperor. On the 6th day after the death of Valentinian, the infant prince of the same name, who was only 4 years old, was shown in the arms of his mother to the legions, and solemnly invested by military acclamation with the titles and ensigns of supreme power. The impending dangers of a civil war were seasonably prevented by the wise and moderate conduct of the Emperor Gratian. He cheerfully accepted the choice of the army, declared that he should always consider the son of Justina as a brother, not as a rival, and advised the Empress with her son Valentinian to fix their residence at Milan in the fair and peaceful province of Italy, while he assumed the more arduous command of the countries beyond the Alps. Gratian dissembled his resentment till he could safely punish or disgrace the authors of the conspiracy, and though he uniformly behaved with tenderness and regard to his infant colleague, he gradually confounded in the administration of the Western Empire the office of a guardian with the authority of a sovereign. The government of the Roman world was exercised in the united names of Valens and his two nephews. But the feeble emperor of the East, who succeeded to the rank of his elder brother, never obtained any weight or influence in the councils of the West. Chapter 26. Manners of the Pastoral Nations. Progress of the Huns from China to Europe. Flight of the Goths. They passed the Danube. Gothic War. Defeat and death of Valens. Gratian invests Theodosius with the Eastern Empire. His character and success. Peace and settlement of the Goths. Part 1. In the second year of the reign of Valentinian and Valens, on the morning of the 21st day of July, the greatest part of the Roman world was shaken by a violent and destructive earthquake. The impression was communicated to the waters. The shores of the Mediterranean were left dry by the sudden retreat of the sea. Great quantities of fish were caught with the hand. Large vessels were stranded on the mud, and a curious spectator amused his eye, or rather his fancy, by contemplating the various appearance of valleys and mountains which had never since the formation of the globe been exposed to the sun. But the tide soon returned, with the weight of an immense and irresistible deluge, which was severely felt on the coasts of Sicily, of Dalmatia, of Greece, and of Egypt. Large boats were transported and lodged on the roofs of houses, or at the distance of 2 miles from the shore. The people, with their habitations, were swept away by the waters, and the city of Alexandria annually commemorated the fatal day on which 50,000 persons had lost their lives in the inundation. This calamity, the report of which was magnified from one province to another, astonished and terrified the subjects of Rome, and their affrighted imagination enlarged the real extent of a momentary evil. They recollected the preceding earthquakes which had subverted the cities of Palestine and Bithynia. They considered these alarming strokes as the prelude only of still more dreadful calamities, and their fearful vanity was disposed to confound the symptoms of a declining empire and a sinking world. It was the fashion of the times to attribute every remarkable event to the particular will of the deity. The alterations of nature were connected by an invisible chain with the moral and metaphysical opinions of the human mind, and the most sagacious divines could distinguish, according to the color of their respective prejudices, that the establishment of heresy tended to produce an earthquake, or that a deluge was the inevitable consequence of the progress of sin and error. Without presuming to discuss the truth or propriety of these lofty speculations, the historian may content himself with an observation which seems to be justified by experience, that man has much more to fear from the passions of his fellow creatures than from the convulsions of the elements. The mischievous effects of an earthquake or deluge, a hurricane or the eruption of a volcano, bear a very inconsiderable portion to the ordinary calamities of war, as they are now moderated by the prudence or humanity of the princes of Europe, who amuse their own leisure and exercise the courage of their subjects in the practice of the military art. But the laws and manners of modern nations protect the safety and freedom of the vanquished soldier, and the peaceful citizen has seldom reason to complain that his life, or even his fortune, is exposed to the rage of war. In the disastrous period of the fall of the Roman Empire, which may justly be dated from the reign of Valens, the happiness and security of each individual were personally attacked, and the arts and labors of ages were rudely defaced by the barbarians of Scythia and Germany. The invasion of the Huns precipitated on the provinces of the West the Gothic nation, which advanced in less than 40 years from the Danube to the Atlantic, and opened a way, by the success of their arms, to the inroads of so many hostile tribes, more savage than themselves. The original principle of motion was concealed in the remote countries of the North, and the curious observation of the pastoral life of the Scythians or Tartars will illustrate the latent cause of these destructive immigrations. The different characters that mark the civilized nations of the globe may be ascribed to the use and the abuse of reason, which so variously shapes and so artificially composes the manners and opinions of a European or a Chinese. But the operation of instinct is more sure and simple than that of reason. It is much easier to ascertain the appetites of a quadruped than the speculations of a philosopher. And the savage tribes of mankind, as they approach nearer to the condition of animals, preserve a stronger resemblance to themselves and to each other. The uniform stability of their manners is the natural consequence of the imperfection of their faculties. Reduced to a similar situation, their wants, their desires, their enjoyments still continue the same, and the influence of food or climate, which in a more improved state of society is suspended or subdued by so many moral causes, most powerfully contributes to form and to maintain the national character of barbarians. In every age, the immense plains of Scythia or Tartary have been inhabited by vagrant tribes of hunters and shepherds, whose indolence refuses to cultivate the earth, and whose restless spirit disdains the confinement of a sedentary life. In every age, the Scythians and Tartars have been renowned for their invincible courage and rapid conquests. The thrones of Asia have been repeatedly overturned by the shepherds of the north, and their arms have spread terror and devastation over the most fertile and warlike countries of Europe. On this occasion, as well as on many others, the sober historian is forcibly awakened from a pleasing vision, and is compelled with some reluctance to confess that the pastoral manners which have been adored with the fairest attributes of peace and innocence are much better adapted to the fierce and cruel habits of a military life. To illustrate this observation, I shall now proceed to consider a nation of shepherds and of warriors in the three important articles of, 1, their diet, 2, their habitations, and 3, their exercises. The narratives of antiquity are justified by the experience of modern times, and the banks of the Borysthenes, of